to win the work and then to deliver it successfully and work with the board to continue driving innovation at sort of every step of the way. I mean, you know, to me, obviously, you know, recovery is, I'd like to think, one of the most open, best examples of open government out there. It should be accessible to the average citizen to find out quickly what's actually happening in their local community. And I think that's rare, even with a lot of the open gov stuff that's happening now. It's also obviously, you know, as Vivek said when he announced it on his blog, it's the first government-wide program to really run in the cloud. And it's a direct cost savings to the government versus not running in the cloud, and it actually returned money back in terms of hardware. So I think it's a great case study there. But overall, from my perspective, I think what recovery.gov and the work we've done in partnership with the board represents in a broader Gov 2.0 sense is the speed at which change and technology solutions should be able to occur if done right. The entire thing went from we won the proposal to we delivered the initial website in less than 10 weeks.
It was incredibly fast.
It was funny because the board kept commenting, and they were, you know, tremendous clients and partners in what we were doing, but they kept commenting that, it felt like some sort of, startup that you imagine out in the valley where, people were running, 24-hour cycles and, one shift was leaving, another was going, and we had to really make a lot of decisions in parallel and work very collaboratively. But that kind of mindset in terms of being able to go in, craft a strategy, pull together a variety of best-in-class solutions, recovery.gov leverages SharePoint, it leverages Amazon Web Services, it leverages Google Translator, it leverages Bing Search, it leverages YouTube. I mean, really at every single point in the process, we were constantly asking the question of what is the simplest, fastest way to solve this problem, and then we can enhance and improve and tweak later as we go. You didn't see a lot of, 400-page requirements documents in the process.
And I mean, I think some people, and we've seen this discussion go on in the past couple of weeks where OMB has put out these new memos on particularly big systems and the history of failure there. And some people have said that recovery.gov and the recovery folks have been able to do this because it's a fairly small organization. There's, they can make decisions. They can be much more agile than if you're developing a case management system for the FBI, which is an enormous system. How much is that size a factor?
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly, an advantage. I mean, the decision-making pathways, there was Chairman Devaney, there was Mike Wood, there was the Smartronics team, even inside Synteractive. I was intimately involved as CEO. The key decision makers were regularly around a table figuring out how we wanted to proceed forward on things. And certainly Chairman Devaney provided wonderfully decisive leadership at sort of some key points there. But even in terms of recovery.gov, I mean, the number of stakeholders that we had to engage with, we were dealing with CIOs of a variety of state governments. We had to deal with, OMB and what the data standards were going to be, all of the recipients that had to report in. You had all of the different agencies that were vested stakeholders in what we were doing, Congress, various other White House officials. I mean, it's a complex project in its own right, even if it's not all within one agency. But I think more directly answering your question in terms of large systems, I mean, one of the problems I tend to see a lot in government is the idea of large systems as opposed to the idea of any large system is simply a composite of smaller, discrete, well-composed systems that can orchestrate together. I mean, that in my mind is really where the state of the art in architecture is. Yeah. And you hear it spoken of regularly in government, we got to do SOA, but you don't really see it implemented to much benefit. Yeah.
And to the end that, and I was talking to Steve Kelman, the former OFVP administrator, there's this constant talk about doing small, rather than the big bang, do things small and roll those out and almost have it be an iterative approach. And that seems to tie in with what you're saying, that that's possible to do today. It does take some planning, some thought at the beginning.
Absolutely. The same team, Smartronics, TMP Government, KPMG, and Synteractive, recently just won Treasury.gov. The interesting part there is we were replicating, very much what we did with recovery on a almost a broader scale in terms of the number of different data sets and the amount of content and the number of viewers and everything with Treasury. And that's Treasury.gov and FinancialStability.gov and making them affordable. But the interesting thing there was it's almost been it's been interesting to go from recovery to treasury because in writing the proposal, we've almost in essence orchestrated out exactly what every sprint would be in the architecture and all that stuff. So we're able to get the teams working in parallel in a coordinated fashion so much quicker because we've done it before, but we put so much planning into thinking through how you attack that problem. That's really required when you want to do those kinds of composite applications and how they fit together.
Almost how do you do that? And I guess what I'm looking for are lessons learned from the recovery.gov experience, because this was so cutting edge.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the work we're doing, for example, with Treasury is significantly benefiting from a lot of the lessons learned that we got from recovery. I mean, it goes without saying when you want to orchestrate a lot of teams working in parallel that we literally had teams on recovery that were just orchestration teams. So the way we organized the project, for example, is there were teams that were responsible for building things, the content management system, the data layer, the cloud infrastructure, et cetera. And then we had teams that were just responsible for driving and ensuring communication and orchestrating. But each one of these teams, I mean, the orchestration teams might have been one or two people, and they had cross overlap with the teams that were building things. And so I don't know that there's a wonderfully secret sauce to it, but I think it comes down to having, you know, high quality senior people that know what they're doing, that have done these kinds of things before and are able to kind of wear a number of different hats and pivot effectively. I mean, it's always interesting to me when, you know, I've only been involved in public sector at all for probably 4 or 5 years. And when I first got involved, it was always amazing to me because I'd have conversations with potential partners and they'd go, well, I want to have 3 SharePoint developers, and then I want to have a network engineer over here, and then I want to have a UI developer in this place. And I'd always look at them and go, well, I don't know how to respond to that. I mean, I have most of my people could fill a number of those different hats depending upon where they had to pivot in the course of a given engagement, and all of them are fundamentally problem solvers. But I think there does tend to be in government contracting a lot that, you know, fitting the square peg into the square hole and the round peg into the round hole. And, you know, in that most successful teams I've ever been involved with, that's not really how it works.
Hmm. So the successful teams do what? If that's what doesn't work, what do successful teams do? And what do successful contracts do? What would be a better way of contracting?
Well, recovery.gov was a fixed price, which gave us a very vested interest in
making it work
and driving it very efficiently. Yeah. You know, it's interactive. We try to do as much fixed price as we can because we feel like it aligns our incentives with the client in the right kind of way. You know, you had very short decision-making lines. You had people with a diversity of skill sets, as I said. You know, you didn't have to swap one person out, bring the next one in at each phase in the process. And then also, I mean, I think there's a certain... You know, there's a certain mentality that you have to instill in the team that from the government side and from Smartronics, Interactive, TMP, KPMG, we all shared was a very tremendous working backwards from, we know it's going to be delivered successfully now. At any given point, you're figuring out how you're going to get there versus a sort of we're here to work the number of hours we've been told to work on, the things we've been told to work on, and the outcome is perhaps an output of that. I'm not sure if that makes any sense, but It is more of a startup mentality. It is more of a West Coast mentality in terms of how you solve technology problems.
And just get it done. Just go do it. Figure out how to get it done.
Yeah.
And without, it seems to me, too much focus on process and a very focus on making sure you have the right people. It's getting the right people who are smart and are those achievers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we... At Synteractive, the single biggest attribute we recruit for and we hire for is what I call people of accomplishment. So I'd rather take a junior software developer who might have 2 or 3 years, but who, you know, successfully climbed 3 of the 7 highest peaks in the world, you know, because there's a skill set that you learn and an attribute that you learn when you take on really difficult challenges. And you learn to see them through despite the 10 points along the way that you're convinced you're going to fail. That is almost more important to me than the particular functional skill set you bring to things. Hmm. Personality counts in terms of successful project teams.
We're talking to Evan Burfield. He is from Center Active. They just won the contract for all of Treasury sites. Most of Treasury sites?
Most of the Treasury sites.
Most of the Treasury sites. So we'll be seeing those roll out, in a couple weeks, right?
We actually have we have three different sprints. So later this summer, you'll start to see Treasury.gov and FinancialStability.gov and Making Homes Affordable relaunched.
Websites. We're talking about websites, and I think some people initially, when the recovery.gov website was, the contract was awarded, a lot of buzz around, and it's all this money for just building a website. But in so many ways, this isn't just a website. These aren't just websites. And I almost think there's if it's a word, underestimation of what these sites are, what this place is.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would... Describing recovery.gov as a website, you know, I think understates what's really involved in it. I usually use the term platform, and we really have designed it to be a platform. You know, this is a Gov 2.0 concept. It's government as a platform. It's the idea that people should be able to come in and almost build their own websites based off of recovery.gov. So, you know, you've got, you know, data being gathered from, gosh, I think it's on the order of 80,000 different entities that are all coming in. You have the data that's coming in from different federal agencies. That all has to be, you know, brought together, made sense of. And then we're taking all that data and visualizing it, putting it through geospatial layers and doing all that. Now, wrapping all around that is, you know, managing web content. So there are some of the basic tasks of, I want to post a new news article about something that's happened on recovery. I should be able to do that with three or four clicks and it goes live and I don't have to talk to a webmaster. You know, there are some just good website components to it, but the complex piece in all of this generally comes down to the data. And I think, you know, part of what was really exciting for us when we were looking at proposing Treasury.gov was how incredibly rich. I didn't even realize until I started digging into it how many rich data sets that have so much impact on so many different constituents the Treasury Department has.
And it's always been my big interest in Gov 2.0 is government uniquely has those incredibly rich data sets that all of a sudden, if they're available in some form or way, we've seen weather data and the Weather Channel now exists. Imagine what happens if we free some of this data up.
Oh, completely. I mean, you talk about really trying to drive transformational efficiency. There are entire companies that exist to just go in and scrape or have analysts take data off Treasury websites, package it up, and deliver it to financial service firms. I mean, the right way that should be done is a financial service firm should be able to write a macro in Excel that automatically pulls that data directly off Treasury.gov. I mean, that's where the world is clearly going to, and it's exciting to see Treasury putting themselves in such a leadership position to get there.
Give me your definition of Gov 2.0, because it seems like to me there's a lot of conversation out there. And my definition always has been it's this power of information. Information is able to be shared. And as that goes on, magical things happen. Really, the power of information, but the power comes through that sharing process. That seems increasingly like that's one aspect of it, but it's actually much larger than that.
Yeah, I always like the definition of, you know, government as a platform, but I always worry that it gets simplified down to just sort of the citizen services piece, you know, or citizen and external stakeholder piece.
Right.
You know, to me, the key attributes of sort of government 2.0, by which I would mean government reform leveraged by really innovative use of technology. You know, you've got the whole citizen services, how do we make citizens better able to access and engage with their government, which is really just, you know, the next iteration of, you know, eGov stuff that's been, you know, that Mark Forman was driving, you know, 5-10 years ago. And you're just seeing the next iteration of that with newer and better technologies.
10 years ago, in fact.
10 years ago.
2000 after, yeah. I mean, it's been on the agenda for a while now.
Yeah, it has been. And I think... You know, eGov started back when websites started. Well, then you had Web 2.0. Now you have Gov 2.0. I mean, that part's pretty straightforward. But if you just isolate it down to a better way to deliver information to citizens online, I think you're missing it. Obviously, cloud computing is a key part of it for a number of reasons. One, it's a can be a tremendous cost saver. But also, I mean, it's agility. We didn't, you know, we were maybe a little bit innocent when we bid recovery, because we looked at it and said, okay, we've got to deliver an incredibly complex platform in 10 weeks. We're going to have to bid the Amazon cloud, because how else are we going to stand up a dev and test environment fast enough to even get there?
Yeah,
it wasn't for us. We want to be transformative. It was just, this is the most efficient path for us to be really agile in getting there. And, you know, that to me is a key part of it. But you also have to look at the performance management components of it and really using information to actually drive efficiency gains inside government. And you've got to look at collaboration within government. You know, government as a platform is as much relevant to government itself as it is to the external stakeholders of government. You know, and that kind of collaboration amongst agencies and, you know, eliminating many of the redundancies and inefficiencies you see in government and the calcification in terms of government's ability to react sometimes is, for me, a really important part of Gov 2.0 that doesn't get as much headlines.
I want to talk a little bit more about cloud, because I keep hearing almost a pushback in this cloud environment that, and maybe it's just that it's, we talk about it so much that it's, people feel it's more hype than reality. How much is really there? Why is cloud important?
It's a difficult question for me to answer, because we built recovery.gov on the cloud. We launched it onto physical hardware. We let that run for a few months. We all looked at it and went, gosh, the dev and test environment on the cloud is an awful lot cheaper and it's actually giving us better performance. This kind of seems redundant. So we took down the physical environment, you know, put everything production on the cloud and again, saved the government $750,000 over the next 18 months and gave them back $1 million in, you know, physical hardware. And I think if we'd all had it to do over again and we knew the way it was going to turn out, we probably wouldn't even have built the physical production environment in the first place. So to me, the cloud is not just real, but I mean, it's happening right now. Same thing with Treasury. I mean, that the interesting thing for me with Treasury is Recovery didn't ask for a cloud solution. We came up with a cloud solution because we thought it was the most agile and efficient path to get there. Treasury demanded a cloud solution. I mean, the RFP said, you're building this thing on the cloud. And I think, you know, we're seeing more and more RFIs and RFPs. Some are, we want to do cloud-specific stuff. A lot of them are starting to look at, I don't want a cloud solution. I just want the most efficient way to get there. So look at cloud for me. So, for example, you know, PTO just came out with a really interesting RFP that says, take all of this patent and trademark office data, make it free to patent and trademark office and free to citizens, figure out how you get there. Now, there's obviously a number of large technology companies that are probably pretty interested in that. But what cloud computing means is there's any number of firms like Cineractive that can look at that and say, I don't have any upfront capital to go do an interesting deal like that. I don't have to go out and procure data centers and buy computers and do all those things. I can go provide potentially a very innovative solution to the government leveraging cloud computing that wouldn't have been feasible 2 years ago.
Talk a little bit about, and we're going to give you a little chance to talk about your company, because talk about Cineractive. Who are you? And I mean, you're a young guy. How old are you? You're 30 something.
I am 33.
There you go. And you're heading up this company, and it's not, I mean, you're not huge. You're not like, I mean, you're not Raytheon or something like that.
No, I would say we would be several orders of magnitude. Yeah.
So who are you? And you're not also, I know you're not all government. It's government and public and private sector.
You know, it was actually pretty interesting for us. I mean, what we really started Cineractive, so Cineractive is the third company I built, third startup I've done. And they've all been generally involving kind of technology and strategy and changing organizations. And we started Cineractive because we really felt like there is a fundamental transformation occurring in the way that, put it this way, if you were going to start from scratch today in a green field, be it a government agency or a company or a social movement, the way that you'd go about organizing people and enabling them to communicate and setting everything up would just look fundamentally different than the way it would have 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. You know, it would be much more agile. It'd be much more virtual. It would have really dynamic workflows, not big structured business processes. It would really enable a whole bunch of people to engage and collaborate in what you're doing. You know, it's the difference between globalgiving.com and the United Way.
Right.
I mean, think about it. If you were going to try to start a really great charity today, you probably wouldn't create the United Way. No offense to the United Way, because I know they're doing a lot of innovative things too, but it probably looked like Global Giving.
Encyclopedia Britannica versus Wikipedia.
Wikipedia. I mean, yeah. You just don't create things. And so what was really interesting to us was, you know, and a lot of us come from that kind of background, was, okay, so who helps the big existing organizations become competitive, bring that kind of agility, and drive that kind of change, both from a strategy and organization standpoint and a technology standpoint? So that was really how we started Centeractive. And our backgrounds are all from financial services and, nonprofits, and really weren't government guys, if that makes sense. But when we were starting in 2006, we kind of got really engaged. Our first client was the Army Corps of Engineers, and we were really working with the Corps post-Katrina to really figure out how to create, communities of practice and different ways of kind of sharing information. And, you know, we ended up doing more and more of this government stuff, and I think we were really surprised by how much interest and willingness there was even before the current administration to kind of figure out some interesting new ways to do things inside government. And certainly with the new administration and the Gov 2.0 agenda, it's been tremendous for us. So, you know, we do financial services, we do, the local YMCA, we did a lot of work for them. We'll do, strategy consulting. And then we also have a whole product arm. So, you know, part of what we're doing is really high end going and solving problems. But part of what we do is actually trying to, you know, we have an aversion to solving the same problem twice. So anytime we see the same thing being repeated, we kind of go off and start tinkering around. And how can we create a product that can do this?
Talk to me a little bit about, I was at this Next Gen conference, all these young people. And it was really fun because there's an excitement. And we're at this place in time where the older folks are actually turning to younger people and saying, okay, you have to teach me how to do some of these things because that's not the way I think. pardon me. How much of that is generational and how much of it is just a mindset?
Oh, I'd say it's absolutely a mindset. I mean, I founded my first company when I was 19 and sold that by the time I was 24 and felt old at the time and had a quarter life crisis and went off to Europe and ultimately came back to build Centeractive. So from my perspective, I certainly feel much older than I did when I started in this game. But, you know, honestly, some of the most innovative conversations I still have are with, for example, Mark Forman. You know, we're of a different generation, but I think there's a very shared mindset in terms of how do you create things? How do you drive efficiency? And frankly, there's an awful lot of people my age who I don't even understand what they're saying because they're stringing together a long set of buzzwords about Web 2.0, social graph, etc. And, you know, that's not necessarily about solving problems. It's about trying to sound hip and cool. So, you know, I think there is certainly something to the view that, you know, the generation that grew up in a world of Facebook and I'm not sure if there even is a generation that grew up in the world of Twitter, but, you know, that grew up dealing with sharing information in that kind of way, perhaps has a different perspective, but you definitely want to blend that with the perspective of what's actually required to drive meaningful organizational change in big, complex organizations, which is hard stuff to do.
And as I said, we were talking with Steve Kelman about the challenges of doing these big projects, and these things are hard.
Trying to change the way a large organization behaves, trying to drive culture change, whether you're a consultant brought in to do it or whether you're a leader who's been tasked to do it, to me is one of the absolute hardest things there is to do in business, period. Speaking just from experience, it's an awful lot easier to build a culture from the ground up that's the way you want it and grow that culture as an entrepreneur than it is to try to come into an organization which, you know, has misaligned incentives and, you know, negative dynamics going on and doesn't really understand its mission and all that and trying to fix it. I mean, I think that's why, you know, you see so many of these efforts fail is not because the people involved in them are incompetent. It's because it's really, really hard to do successfully.
And we were talking during the break that there are a lot of people very worried and seeing maybe a decrease or maybe less of an increase in IT spending in the government and really almost running around like, oh my goodness, the sky is falling. you have a different perspective on that.
Oh, I from my perspective, you know, I really am encouraged and applaud the administration for starting to bring down the IT budget, because to me, that's the ultimate mechanism through which you drive real change. I mean, efficiency doesn't occur because people naturally go, gosh, how do I do more with less? Efficiency occurs because people have less and they're still tasked with doing more.
You're faced with the Apollo 13 moment, or eight, whatever it is, moment, where you have what's on the table and you say, we have to get this done. Yeah. These are the tools we have. Let's figure out how to do it.
Oh, gosh. I mean, necessity is the ultimate mother of invention, and that's absolutely true inside organizations. I mean, if you look at the potential of cloud computing, for example, I mean, you have the potential to save taxpayers tremendous billions and billions and billions of dollars while also increasing agility and increasing the ability of government agencies to be flexible in how they share and use information. I mean, I see cloud computing as an integral part of that, but you're also talking about unbelievably threatening change to an awful lot of people who have built their careers on growing the budget that they control and the headcount they control every year, and suddenly being told the best thing you can do is give up an unbelievable amount of that headcount, slash that budget, and you're going to be rewarded for it, goes very much against most people's natural instincts. And, you know, so to start to drive some of that change, the macro level screw you start to turn is you have to start demanding people do more with less. And from our perspective, you know, we're a small, agile, very fast moving, innovative company. It's in our DNA. So we see an environment in which people have to figure out how to take on more complex challenges with less resources as, you know, a big advantage to us versus a lot of the more traditional systems integrators.
I was at this NextGen conference, and they were talking about this row, this results only work environment, where you don't have a time clock. There's no 9 to 5. What they focus on is, are you doing the job? Mm-hmm. My friend Tom Shoup over at Government Executive posted about it, and one of the commenters responded, this just seems like a waste. This is a waste of money. We need people in. It's always, as long as I've been covering this stuff, people have said, hold on, we have to focus on the results. Again, almost a crowbar to force you to focus on the results, get away from micromanaging the individual parts.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, to really start to drive this in the right way and start to focus on results, you're talking about, you know, turning that dial on the overall IT budget. You're talking about changing the way a lot of procurements go. And I think we've been seeing a lot more innovative approaches to procurement, or at least I have been seeing a lot more innovative approaches to procurement, even within the existing rules over the last, you know, year. For us at Cinteractive, right, the number one value of the firm is get stuff done. We have other values. Those are important values. But at the end of the day, you know, I don't really care how much time and effort my people put into things. I care whether they got the job done. And, you know, the fact that we seek out fixed price contracts, that flows down through the culture of things. But if government really wants to be changing the way people do things, then government should start paying for results and not paying for cost plus bodies.
Hmm. So you've won the contract on Treasury. This moves forward. How quickly can these things actually happen? You said things can move very, very quickly these days. And I think almost we're in that mode where we go, oh, my goodness, this has to take 6 months to, or, you know, 6 years to roll out. You look, your timeframes are not 6 years.
Absolutely not. I mean, I think, you know, we measure.
You'll be in your 40s in 6 years.
Exactly.
For goodness
sakes. I'd be 39 just to be. You know, absolutely. And I mean, I think the kinds of change that, you know, we're looking to drive, I mean, recovery.gov, you know, we obviously have a vested interest in its success, but it really was an incredibly transformational project in terms of showing people what can be done in government for citizens, for other agencies as a project in an incredibly short period of time. I mean, people don't realize, but I mean, we did the actual migration from physical to virtual, you know, from physical to cloud with recovery in less than a month.
Yeah.
We just sat down, we looked at it, we built it, and, you know, we replicated the production architecture in Amazon. We slid it over and we tested it. We made sure it was secure. You know, that's the types of timescales that are possible. Now, whether that's the speed at which everyone necessarily wants to move, I think, is the challenge. But it's not a matter of the fact that you can't move that quickly if the will is there.
So lessons learned from recovery.gov? Do you have three lessons that you take away and you go back? Either things that worked really well or maybe one that didn't work particularly well?
I think if we had it to do over again, which might be a good way to put it, we probably would have done everything on the cloud from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, that was a matter of we were so much on the leading edge that even we were going, you know, it probably makes more sense to go physical first and then migrate to the cloud. But we would have saved the government even more money, you know, had we gone straight to the cloud. I think other key lessons learned. So I think the lesson there, if you're going to put it into a soundbite, is cloud is real. Cloud has tremendous benefits. Many of the excuses that you're hearing are often more psychological than they are actual real issues. You know, and again, recovery.gov was the first, FISMA certified platform in the cloud. So it's there. It's real. Next lesson would be get the acquisition vehicle structured correctly. So I think the fact that we had fairly aligned incentives with the board in terms of a fixed price contract with Smartronics and with the board and everything, I think was great. And then again, I think the third part would be, you need to create the right kind of culture in these projects, and you need to get the right kind of people for success. So if you're trying to achieve efficiency on a 5-year operations and maintenance contract, that's a different type of person than if you're trying to do something really innovative, really agile in a really short period of time. You know, you need to hire agile, innovative people if you want to achieve agility and innovation.
Yeah. Are there ways that places that cloud works and places that it doesn't? Sometimes I think we have a hammer, so we start using a hammer for everything. And like what we need is a screwdriver here.
Yeah, I mean, I think cloud is one of those classic buzzwords right now, right? I mean, you know, I love all of the basic hosted applications that all of a sudden have spun right around. It's, oh, we're a cloud strategy, cloud play. And that's inevitable.
Marketing people gone wild.
And, you know, I'm only 33, but I've been through enough of these technology cycles to sort of watch this. But I think if you're really defining it in the truest sense, which is, you know, a real public cloud, utility computing, Amazon Web Services, Microsoft Azure, Google type cloud play, you know, force.com, things like this, you're almost sort of peeling the onion of government from the outside in, right? So the very first thing you're seeing going is government websites. It'd be very hard to, you know, treasury.gov is FISMA moderate. I mean, you know, that application that we're rolling out there is at an even higher level of security than what we did with recovery.gov, and it's feasible and it's achievable. So right now, if I were a CIO in the federal government and I weren't looking at what my public cloud strategy is for my public facing website, you know, I think I would question whether I was maximizing my use of dollars at the time. From there, I think you're starting to see the RFIs coming out. You're starting to see people thinking about things like GSA with the email as a service, where you're starting to get that next level of sort of intranets and email, and they're more mission critical. They're a little bit more inside the firewall. I think it'll be a long time before you really start to see, you know, core financial systems, classified applications, things like that moving to the cloud, just because, you know, the complexity of the security requirements and the change management is much greater.
And it's almost what's going on is, and we talk about inherently governmental all mm-hmm. the time, but companies do this too. Yes, email, very important. Mission critical. Have to have it running. Do I really need to own all the stuff that makes it run?
Exactly. But
I mean, electrical, I'm very dependent on electricity to have all this stuff work around us, but I don't need to own a power plant.
Yeah, I think the quote I've always loved, you know, in describing particularly infrastructure as a service cloud computing is, you know, when electricity was first invented, every building that wanted it ran out and bought a generator. And then at a certain point, everybody realized, wow, that's incredibly inefficient. And then you had a public power grid. And I think that is the macro change that's occurring in technology right now. So, yes, there are very appropriate uses for private cloud. DISA and NASA are doing really cool, innovative things with that, and I think you'll see more of that. But the sea change is towards the idea that you plug it in and you just pay on a metered basis for what you need when you need it. And then when you don't need it anymore, you unplug it. And, you know, interestingly, you know, we work really closely with Microsoft. We work really closely with Amazon. We have great conversations with them about what we're seeing in cloud. Government's actually almost adopting a lot of that stuff in that sense, big enterprise stuff, almost faster than some of the public sector stuff or some of the commercial stuff that you're seeing. I mean, I think it's a very exciting time right now.
Yeah. Exciting time generally. I mean, yeah. And this is what I was saying to the young folks at this Next Gen conference. I mean, there's such a push for change in government, whether it's Obama, you know, we can make change happen or whatever. There's a real push. People are tired of the same old, same old.
You know, I mean, I certainly, you know, we would be the first to say, obviously, you know, when the president stood up in February of last year and said, you know, when we pass the stimulus, everyone's going to go to recovery.gov. We've certainly benefited from being able to work with the administration to deliver solutions like that. But I don't know that it's a this administration so much as it is this time. So yeah. We've been having some great conversations with the Cameron coalition government in the UK. You know, they're almost trying to out Obama, the Obama guys, yeah. In terms of Gov 2.0.
There is competition going on.
Yeah.
It's almost not. I mean, I know Australia, the Australian folks yeah. will carefully watch what recovery has done, and they're going, okay, we're not going to get beaten by them.
Absolutely. And that's really, regardless of ideology or party or anything else, it's that the generation of leadership that is coming to the fore right now around the world in different states in the U.S., et cetera, just bluntly isn't willing to put up with a lot of the sort of frustration and lack of progress, lack of innovation that you were perhaps seeing in a previous generation of technology systems.
And there is also these tools just make it easier. And a number of the young folks mentioned, you know, hold on. In most cases, people have better, more computing power at home and can do more at home than they can on their machine at work, which is probably a desktop that's 10 years old or something.
A really, really, really great example for me. So when we first started doing recovery.gov, searching for jobs, citizens being able to search for recovery jobs wasn't a priority requirement. And as going through the very iterative process we did, we reached out to some stakeholders in Congress, and we actually did focus groups around the country. And what we were finding was so many people were saying right at the top of the list of things people wanted to see was job search. And so Chairman Devaney, you know, made it very clear that he was listening to the citizens and they wanted job search. And so we had like a week to figure out how to implement a job search function. And we basically got together with Microsoft and we said, hey, would it be possible to just create a custom search scope inside their Bing search platform to just search recovery.gov websites for things that sound like job posts? Or, the websites of recipients of recovery funds for things that sounded like job postings. You know, they said, sure. We built a quick user interface on it. And in literally 2 days, we had a job search function that covered tens of thousands of websites and allowed citizens to find recovery jobs instantly. That mindset, that ability to do things so fast is incredibly powerful if you take on the challenge of operating that way.
We talked about openness and transparency. Mm-hmm. And one of the, of course, maybe the way that recovery.gov became most famous was on Jon Stewart's show, on The Daily Show.
Oh, I think it was actually the Colbert Report.
Oh, the Colbert Report.
Colbert Report.
Jon Stewart, I'm sorry. And that was the wrong data that was in
right.
there. And specifically, this was congressional districts that didn't exist. And we had Chairman Devaney on talk, and I asked him about this and asked him about his lessons learned about transparency, about openness. And one of his things was, if you're easily embarrassed, don't get used to it. You're going to be embarrassed. There is bad data out there. The goal is to fix it.
The entire premise of transparency in government is to drive accountability. We knew, you know, Chairman Devaney knew, the administration knew, everybody on the Smartronics and Centeractive teams knew that there were going to be significant data issues from day one of the project. And the whole recovery.gov is so that people see those issues, create a hue and cry, and drive the change to actually fix that data points. And, you know, it really is accountability through shaming. It's the same thing that Vivek has driven with the IT dashboards. You know, there's there's a large part of it that says, the classic quote, of course, is that sunlight is a great disinfectant. And that's what you're trying to do here. And I think, you know, the administration and Chairman Devaney showed tremendous courage in sticking to their guns through that process, knowing before it ever went live that they were going to take a lot of hits in the first cycle. But what's been fascinating to me is you haven't gotten that on the second and third reporting cycles, because a ton of those data errors got fixed.
Yeah,
they were out there. They were high profile. I mean, in terms of achieving the ultimate administration strategy of driving accountability in the way stimulus funds were spent, getting those data errors on the Colbert report was actually really important, even if it was a bit painful at the time.
And I always say, in terms of openness and transparency, I know everyone, it's not popular to say, it was the Bush administration that decided to make the scorecards public at the time. And this is a decade ago. And that, was a very important step. And it always drove, you know, if somebody was a red on a scorecard, guess what? The secretary was paying attention and saying, okay, what steps are we taking to fix this? And that's just evolved.
Well, and that's what I mean. I mean, you know, Gov 2.0 is... You know, there are revolutionary aspects to it, but a lot of it is just an even faster, more agile iteration of the eGov stuff that's been going on for a while with better technologies available to implement it.